I look forward to continuing in the book of Genesis, chapter 1. It's been a great blessing to be able to study the Lord's work of creation, and we've so far talked about and looked at the first 3 days of the creation, and today I'd like to go on and look at the fourth day of creation where God made the heavenly lights. We saw how on day one, God made light. God said, "Let there be light," and there was light. So there was already light created, and the light divided from the darkness from the very first day of God's creation. And then we saw how God began to continue that structuring work of the universe that He'd created by dividing the waters, by creating the firmament, and then gathering together the waters so that the dry land could appear, and then causing the grass and the herbs and the fruit trees to spring forth from the earth, and already beginning to plan and prepare the way for the creatures that He would make later that would use those plants for food. Now, as we come to verse 14, we begin to see what God did on the fourth day of the creation. So let's read this, beginning in Genesis 1, verse 14. "And God said, 'Let there be lights in the firmament of the heaven to divide the day from the night, and let them be for signs and for seasons and for days and years. And let them be for lights in the firmament of the heaven to give light upon the earth.' And it was so. And God made two great lights, the greater light to rule the day and the lesser light to rule the night. He made the stars also. And God set them in the firmament of the heaven to give light upon the earth and to rule over the day and over the night and to divide the light from the darkness. And God saw that it was good. And the evening and the morning were the fourth day." Now I'd like to go through and just pull out what God is revealing to us here about the lights that He created on the fourth day. But first of all, I want to just observe something that we're going to notice here in the account of the creation. That this creation account that God gives us is one that in first and foremost is very God-centered. God is at the center of this entire creation, and that's the preeminent thing. In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth. We're supposed to have all of our attention directed first and foremost to the almighty sovereign God that created these things. And this revelation is given to us for a reason. God desired that man would have an understanding of these things. That we shouldn't just take that for granted. We recognize that to be true because He's given us the Bible. But that in itself is something significant, that God intended for man to have this knowledge, so that God very early on would reveal things that occurred before man was even created, so that man could look back and see and have God have God's revelation of what God did made known to him. And that itself is significant. And God is at the center of all of this account. Each step of the way, God is speaking. We see God said, and God's creation begins with His speaking. The word that goes forth from God's mouth is the means by which He creates. We also see God dividing. So God is structuring the things that He's created, placing them into the appropriate categories and their appropriate places. And we also see God seeing. It says that God saw that it was good. This is something we're going to see throughout the book of Genesis and throughout the Bible, that seeing is associated again and again with judging, with passing judgment. It says, "And God saw that it was good." When God beheld with His eyes, He observed what He had created, and He passed judgment upon it, that it was good. We'll see similar language when when Eve is in the garden and she looks upon the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, and she sees the fruit and she judges that it's good for food and a value to make one wise, what partially her judgment is right, partially it's wrong, but the act of seeing is one of passing judgment on something. So God is speaking, God is dividing, God is forming, God is making, creating, and God is seeing and passing a judgment and evaluating what he's made. But secondly, I think it's appropriate to say that this account of the creation is also both very earth-centered, and as we'll see as things go on, it's also very man-centered in the right kind of way. And we begin, if we haven't already seen that, we begin to really see it here when God describes the heavenly lights. It says that on the fourth day of creation, and God said, "Let there be lights in the firmament of the heaven to divide the day from the night, and let them be for signs and for seasons and for days and years, and let them be for lights in the firmament of the heaven to give light upon the earth." And it was so. So the purposes that God gives when God creates the heavenly lights, we'll see what they are, the sun, the moon, and the stars, the purposes are related back to the earth. And particularly in being related back to the earth, they're related to man. And this gives us a different picture of the creation than we would necessarily get from perhaps the modern scientific view of the creation, where we look out and we, you know, have enough technology to see that the sun is just one of many bodies in the sky that are large, that are bright, that are putting off light. And in fact, it's not even the biggest and the brightest, but there's many other stars that are much brighter, much greater in size and mass and brightness than the sun. We also know that the earth is not the greatest, the biggest planet in the universe, but that there are many planets. But see, that is a very modern way of looking at the universe. And God is revealing to us something that is different from that. God is revealing to us the heavenly perspective of how he wants us to perceive the universe. And in God's creation, the earth is very special. The earth is special in a number of ways, but the earth is at the center of this creation account. All these things that God is making are on the earth or surrounding the earth. And that's not to say that in terms of the geography that the earth is necessarily at the center of the universe physically, but in terms of God's plan and God's purpose, God's purposes are centered upon the earth. And God's purposes are centered with man. God sets man up, and we could also look at that in a modern way of seeing it, is that humankind is just one of many different types of creatures that exist in this universe. And yet the account we have in Genesis shows that man is created as very special. There's something very special about mankind, both male and female, in God's creation. And it's summed up in the phrase that we'll see, that man was made in the image of God. God made man, as among all the creatures that he made, very special. And in fact, man is so special in God's purpose that when God himself would come down and dwell in his creation, would set foot upon the earth, he would take upon himself the flesh of man. He would take upon himself human nature so that God would be manifest in the flesh. That is, he would become man and dwell among us. So it's right in harmony with that when God reveals the creation of the sun and the moon and the stars, their purposes revolve around the earth. They are first and foremost, primarily, they are lights. They are lights. It says, and God said, let there be lights in the firmament of the heaven to divide the day from the night, and let them be for signs and for seasons and for days and years, and let them be for lights in the firmament of heaven to give light upon the earth. And it was so. So God gave these things to be lights upon the earth. And now let's break this down. First of all, it says, let there be lights in the firmament of heaven to divide the day from the night. Now we know back on day one that God already divided the light from the darkness. But as God is often doing, his work, his plan and his purposes are unfolding. They're progressing. So God in the beginning, he made light. But the way that he made light is, we can see a distinction here from day one and day four. In day one it says, and God said, let there be light, and there was light. God speaks, let there be light, and it says, there was light. It doesn't necessarily say that he made light, like it says in verse 16, that God made two great lights. It says, and there was light. And so we can see this light that God is that appears on day three, in verse three, as proceeding from God himself. It is God's own glory and radiance that is shining forth into the universe. God says, let there be light, and there was light. And now on day four, God creates lights in the heaven to take over the purpose of dividing the day from the night. We also think about the passage of time here. We notice that the flow, the rhythm of evening and morning and evening and morning and one day to the next, it already existed for 3 days before God even created the sun to mark out and to establish and signify the passage of the day. And so we can see that actually the length of the day and the size of the day and the rhythm of the day is something that actually takes preeminence over the sun itself, because the sun is created to work with and to be used by God to mark out a time and a rhythm of a day that already had been created before. See, time itself is a creation of God. Time itself is something that is created into the universe by God, and that began at the very beginning. It says, in the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth. And one of the first things that we see as creation begins is the passage of time begins. We can't wrap our minds around what it was like before time existed. That is beyond our comprehension. It is the eternal things. God is eternal. He always was. So before the universe and before time, God existed. And God was completely complete. He was completely happy within himself. God was in a state of eternal relationship with the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. God didn't need the universe. God didn't need man. And yet it was flowing out of God's pleasure and God's love that he had within himself, inside the Father, the Son, and the Spirit. Is flowing out of that, that God's desire to create the universe and to create man and extend his love out to man flowed from those things. And so God created the universe and God created time. And now on day four, God delegates the authority of marking out and exposing time to these heavenly lights that he creates. It says that they're created to divide the day from the night. And then he says, let them be for signs and for seasons and for days and for years. Before we talk about what those things are, let's try to get an image here of what God is creating. It says, and God made two great lights, the greater light to rule the day and the lesser light to rule the night. He made the stars also and sent them in the firmament of the heaven to give light upon the earth. Now, with all the technology we have in our day, we don't feel as dependent upon the sun and the stars for things like navigation and for keeping track of time. I mean, I can look at my watch and I can see what time it is and what day it is. And I could be in a dark room with the lights shut off and no access to the sun, and I could know what time it was and what day it was. And And if I was out at sea, I could navigate without the stars. We have GPSs and all kinds of fancy technology to do those things. But if we are to kind of put ourselves in the shoes of ancient people and imagine what it must have been like for them, they were very dependent upon the stars and the sun and the moon and the heavenly bodies for navigation and for the passage of time and the marking out of their festivals. And what they would have seen is if they were to look up at the sky, you know, in the day we see the sun and the sun moves its way across the sky. Now, our modern understanding, we revolve around the sun through gravity, and you know, there's a gravitational attraction between the two bodies. But the way that it appears to us as we look up is we see the sun rise in the east and it makes its course across the sky and it descends down in the west. If we look up at the night sky, we would see, throughout the night sky, we would see all a body of stars that stay fixed in their relationship to each other. So you have the 12 constellations, the Orion and Pleiades and Leo and all those constellations, and you look up and they will rotate, and their position in the sky will change throughout the time of night and throughout the seasons. But their relationship to each other will stay fixed because of their distance from the earth. They stay fixed in the sky. But among those fixed stars in the sky, you would also observe, you would see the moon moving around throughout the constellations, throughout the night. You would also see five other stars that would move throughout those stars, making their course, and that would be Venus and Jupiter, Mars, Mercury, Saturn, and I might have missed one. That one's too far to see without a telescope. So, anyway, there's five of them that we can see without a telescope, and you would see these moving throughout the constellations throughout the night. And ancient people used these things to understand the passage of time and the change of the seasons, and they paid great attention to these things. And so these are the things that are in view here as it says God is creating these two great lights, the greater light to rule the day. We call it the sun, and the lesser light to rule the night, and he made the stars also. And it's very interesting that they're said to rule. They're given rule, and they have a certain amount of authority. And we'll see that stars and heavenly bodies will, throughout the scriptures, they will be used to represent rulers, to represent principalities and powers. So there's a theme that's beginning to make itself manifest. Now let's look at Psalm 104. Psalm 104, we've been going through this psalm and seeing that this psalm parallels in many ways the days of the creation account in Genesis. We looked at how the waters descending from the earth, and how that's, you know, also speaks about the flood, and then after the waters move off of the face of the land, that grass and trees are able to spring up. And then in verse 19 of Psalm 104, it says, "He appointed the moon for seasons, the sun knoweth his going down. Thou maketh darkness, and it is night, wherein all the beasts of the forest do creep forth. The young lions roar after their prey, and seek their meat from God. The sun ariseth, they gather themselves together, and lay them down in their dens. Man goeth forth unto his work, and to his labor, until the evening." So we see now that, as it describes here in this psalm of praise to God for its creation, it describes the moon coming up. God created this moon, and then it describes these creatures that come out at night. And when the sun comes up, the creatures go back into their dens, and then man comes out and he works. And God is already making preparation in the earlier days of the creation for man, who he would create on the sixth day. We see in the third day that God already created food for the creatures not yet created. And there's also an interdependence, because we know that trees and grasses and things like that, they need some of those kinds of plants, they need insects to pollinate them, insects which God would not yet make until the fifth day. And so God is making preparation on both ends, and God is preparing his creation for man. And these heavenly bodies that God is creating are also a testimony of the greatness and the power of God. In Psalm 19, it speaks also about the creation, the handiwork of God, of the firmament. Psalm 19, it says, "The heavens declare the glory of God, and the firmament showeth his handiwork." You know, so even just looking out at the sky reveals the glory and the handiwork of God. It says, "Day unto day uttereth speech, and night unto night showeth knowledge. There is no speech nor language where their voice is not heard." Now, you know, I preach a message, and I preach it in the language that I know, in the English language, and only someone that understands English can listen to this sermon and receive any benefit from it. But he says there's no language or speech where the message that's being declared by the firmament, by the heavens, is not understood. Any person anywhere, even one that doesn't know how to read or write or even know any language at all, could look up and they could observe the glory of God displayed in the things that God has created. And the heavens are, in many respects, they are a culmination of this. I mean, all of God's creation is amazing, is incredible. You meditate on the animals that God has created and the plants that God has created, and it ought to bring awe and wonder to us. But perhaps more incredible than many of these things are the heavenly things that God has created. I mean, and we can look up and we can think about how great distances and the magnitude and the size and the power of the galaxies and the stars that are out there. And it's just amazing. And it says their line is gone out through all the earth, and their worlds and their words to the end of the world. In them, that's speaking about the heavens, hath he set a tabernacle for the sun, which is as a bridegroom coming out of his chamber and rejoiceth to as a strong man to run a race. His going forth is from the end of the heaven, and his circuit unto the ends of it, and there is nothing hid from the heat thereof. So we have here this description of the heavens declaring the glory of God, and the sun making its way across the sky like a chariot, just going across, and nothing's hid from it. And this is the glory of what God is creating. Now back in Genesis 1:14, we see the purpose to which God has created these heavenly lights. I mean, first and foremost, they are lights. They are given as lights. And then within that purpose, he says, "Let them be for signs and for seasons and for days and years." So they are given, first for signs. And particularly, God uses these heavenly lights as signs throughout the scripture. And often when something dramatic is going to take place, God will block out the sun, or or darkness will cover the moon, or there'll be signs in the stars. Think about the birth of Christ and the wise men that came from the east, and they said they saw his star. They saw the star hanging over. There was signs that were given to them. They're also for seasons, And this seasons is not just the seasons like we think of, spring, summer, fall, winter, spring, summer, fall, winter. But these seasons are particularly the festivals that God would give to the people. God would give them the Passover festival and the Feast of Unleavened Bread and the Feast of Tabernacles and the Feast of Trumpets and the Day of Atonement. And in order to know the time that they were supposed to do these feasts and to mark out the passage of the time, God gave He gave them the stars and the moon, and they would use the moon. Our word month comes from the word moon, although we don't use the moon anymore to mark out when the beginning and the ends of our month are. But there's something called a lunar month, month that's marked out from the beginning of the very beginning of the appearing of the sliver of the moon that goes all the way through to the full moon and then the waning of the moon and back down to the new moon. And that would be a way to mark out the passage of the months. Also for days, we've already talked about the day. The day goes from the evening to the morning. And it is, you know, 7 days that make up the week, which is the period of time in which God created the world and then rested. And then that is the rhythm that He passed on to us for both our schedule of work and our schedule of worship, because God would give to His people very early on that the seventh day was holy and it was set aside. And then He would tell them that on that day shall be a holy convocation. That means basically a church service that they would have every seventh day, that the people of God would come together. That day would be set aside for the worship of the Lord. It would be holy. They would come together and they would worship God in the congregation. And so it was set up as the needed pattern for our lives, that our lives might do the appropriate amount of work, but our lives might also be centered around coming to that continual time of worship and appearing before God in His presence. And also for the years, the passage of the earth around the sun, it causes the change of our seasons and ultimately marks out the time of the passage of years. And it says, let them be for lights in the firmament of the heaven to give light upon the earth. And it was so. And God made two great lights, the greater light to rule the day and the lesser light to rule the night. And here's where we also see that these heavenly bodies are set up and they're given rule. Let's just think about this in a physical sense. The sun is said to rule the day. The sun is said to have some kind of rule over the day. Well, we know it has rule because it provides the needed light. We also understand, though, that there's something that we call gravity that causes the earth to move around the sun that has a governing influence over the path of the earth. And it keeps the earth established. And also, perhaps more significantly in the Bible, is that the sun and the moon and the stars, that they would come to represent and symbolize rulers and principalities and powers. And so when God is going to come and He's going to judge a nation, like when He comes and He judges the Babylonians, and He prophesies of their destruction, He speaks about the destruction of their empire in terms of the sun being blotted out and the moon not giving its light. He's talking about their rule and their authority being taken away. We saw how there's no speech or language where the voice and the words of these heavenly bodies are not seen. And that reminds me in Romans 1 about how Paul speaks about how God's glory and His power and His character are made known by the things which God have created. In Romans 1, it says, in verse 18, the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who hold the truth in unrighteousness. because that which may be known of God is manifest in them, for God hath shown it unto them. For the invisible things of him from the creation of the world are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even his eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse. Now, you know, he's saying here that man, in man's sin, man is ultimately without excuse in his rebellion against God. Now, you know, we could look at people like Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and their descendants and the Israelites. You know, they had the direct revelation of God. He gave them the law. He revealed himself to them in miracles. And if they then go and they turn and they rebel against God, it's easier for us to see that they have no excuse. God made himself known to them. He made his will known. But, you know, what about those that didn't have the privilege and the revelation of God that they had? But Paul even addresses that. He says, you know, no man is with excuse if he rebels against the knowledge of God, because he says all men have the knowledge of God, because the glory and the eternal Godhead and the power of God, they're clearly seen. They're clearly displayed because they're understood by the things that are made. See, his creation is clearly seen. All we have to do is look around and see the things that he's created, and we see the evidence of an almighty and all-powerful God. And so he says, they are without excuse. And he says, because that when they knew God, they glorified him not as God, neither were thankful, but became vain in their imaginations, and their foolish heart was darkened. So God created these great lights, and you know, one of the questions that comes up, and it often comes, you know, to this passage of the Genesis account, is questions of modern science and how they either contradict or how they harmonize with the things that are taught in the Bible about God's creation of the world. So I think it's valuable to say a few things about that so that we can understand how the Bible addresses those things. Now, one thing we have to see is that God desires to reveal these things to man, these things that are recorded here, for their own sake, for their own purpose. And by that I mean, God isn't primarily concerned with refuting this one idea or this other idea. Now, I mentioned that way back in the first day that I began speaking about Genesis, that one of the benefits and one of the purposes in the Genesis account here is that it's shaping our worldview, and that in particular, the benefit that that had to the Israelites as they were going into Canaan, the land of Canaan, out of the land of Egypt, is so that their understanding of God would be shaped by the truth and not by the false gods of the place they were coming from or going to. Well, one of the very common false beliefs was to worship the sun and the moon and even the stars. Now, I mentioned how there's five planets that we can see without a telescope, and there's the sun and the moon. And, you know, these became associated with the pagan gods of all the different pagan groups that lived in ancient times. You know, and some of the evidence of that comes down to us even in our language today. Think about how that we refer to the days of the week. Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday. Well, most of these names, you know, sun and moon are pretty obvious. Sunday, moon day. But the other five, those come from the Norse language, but they're the equivalents of the gods that would be referred to in the Roman as Mars, Mercury, Saturn, Jupiter, and Venus. And those were the names of their gods, and they associated them with these heavenly bodies. They looked up at these majestic creations and they worshiped them. And so an effect of this, if we embrace what God has revealed, is that we don't give undue honor to the things that God has created. We recognize them as His creation, that they are to reflect His glory. Just like the moon doesn't have the light of its own, but it reflects the light of the sun, the things that God has created, they reflect His glory, so that our worship would be turned away from the created things to the Creator. And that was the sin, ultimately, in Romans 1 that Paul talks about, is how their hearts were darkened. And they turned away from worshiping the Creator to worshiping the creature, worshiping the thing that was made. So it has that effect. But that's not to say that the primary reason that God is giving this to us in Genesis 1 is so that we wouldn't fall into pagan beliefs. Likewise, the primary reason God is giving this to us here is not so that we can defend against modern scientific beliefs, which may be anti the Bible, which may be opposed to God. But that might be an effect of it. And so we can see how it confronts those things. So, you know, a word about science. Science is very useful and it's a very beneficial thing. But science has to be understood in terms of its limitations. What is science able to understand? What is science able to grapple with and give us understanding about? Things that we can ultimately observe. Observe with our eyes, primarily. Observe with the instruments that we can measure with. And in order to have a good scientific understanding of something, it requires to have repeated experiments that can confirm or refute a hypothesis that we have. You know, as an example, we have a scientific construct known as Newton's laws that help us to understand how physics works in this world. If I take a baseball and I throw it at a certain velocity and a certain angle, you can predict to a fairly specific degree of accuracy how high that ball is going to go and where it's going to land just by using Newton's laws of physics. However, we have to understand that that's only a scientific construct, because scientists know today that on certain scales in the universe, Newton's laws of physics are no longer correct. In the revolution of the planet Mercury, it doesn't exactly follow Newton's laws. It breaks from it. And so Einstein's theory of relativity is used to help explain the revolution of the planet Mercury around the sun. So, but it's still just a scientific construct. It's the best set of rules that we can come up with and then test experimentally. And science is good when you can repeat an experiment over and over and see if it fits with the construct that you've come up with. And so I can throw that ball, and if I can throw it at the same speed and the same angle, you can predict with a fairly certain degree of accuracy where that ball is going to land. Within limits. But here's where the problem is. Where do the real limits come in? What science is not good at is science is not good at predicting the future. And it's also not good at understanding the distant past. And it's really for the same reason. It's because science cannot incorporate into itself what doesn't fit with it. And miracles are a very good example of that. I mean, what we're dealing with in Genesis 1 is we're dealing with miracles. Miracles that are received by faith in a God who is able to perform them. What we see in the resurrection of Christ is a miracle. Science can't test the resurrection of Christ through a series of repeated experiments, because it's a one-time miraculous event that breaks with the normal flow of things. And so what happens is, when you go into the distant past and you begin to deal with discontinuities in the flow of things, whether they're miraculous events or not, or just really incredible events like a worldwide flood, they break the ability to make accurate predictions of how things took place or will take place in the future. So if I throw that ball and I throw it at the same angle at the same speed, but then a bird, a big, huge bird comes along and swallows that ball and flies away with it, your ability to predict where that ball is going to land has completely been obliterated because there was a discontinuity in the flow of how things take place. And so, you know, what we're dealing with in Genesis 1 are miraculous events that break with the normal understanding of how things occur. We understand things and we have to make our predictions, whether future or past predictions, based on expecting that things always basically continued the way that they are today, and in the future that they'll always basically continue the way that they are today. But that's impossible. We cannot predict the future, even with our great scientific understanding. If people could, you know, there'd be people making billions and trillions of dollars predicting what the stock market was going to do, and yet people still haven't figured out how to do that. Because you don't know what's going to happen, because you cannot expect the future is going to be just like the present. So we're dealing with incredible events. And so I don't say all that as if that in itself is sufficient to answer all the questions and the objections that modern science makes. If that's something you need to wrestle with and deal with, then there's great resources for that. There's people that study that in depth, and I'm not qualified to address all those things. But just to point out that what we understand of science, it has great limitations. And so God didn't intend for us to gain our knowledge of holy and heavenly things through scientific pursuit. He has provided another way for us to know. And what is that way? That way is revelation. God reveals himself to us. And God has purposed to progressively, through history, reveal more and more of his purpose and his person and character to man. And so God gave the book of Genesis. And then God gave the book of Exodus and Leviticus and Numbers and the Old Testament and the New Testament over time, through history, through instruments that he's used to pen these things down and inspired them so that we would know what he would desire us to know about him. And so as we continue to study these things, we will see unfold God's revelation of us to of him to us. And the primary purpose of them is not, it's not what's called a polemic. It's not it's not written to refute this idea or that idea. Primarily, the purpose is a kind of organic revelation that God has, so that we would know and we would understand what he would have us to understand. And we see that here in these heavenly lights that God has created. The greatest thing of all that these lights symbolize, though, as we've seen again and again, that these things testify of Christ, the only begotten Son of the Father, full of grace and truth. We see here once again that what God is making and creating is testifying to and revealing and declaring the glory of the Son Jesus Christ, the Son, S-O-N, Son. He reveals the Father. And how is he described? You know, he is described as the light of the world. He is, you know, the Son is like Christ in that respect. And if we are true servants of him, we are, in some ways, we're like the moon, you know, reflecting his light. We don't have any light of our own, but we reflect his light. But also, how else does it describe him? It describes him as the brightness of his glory. The Son is the brightness of the Father's glory. He is the express image of his person. God is described as being clothed with light as a garment. He's so bright. So bright, we can't even look at him. We can't even behold him. But Jesus is described to us as the image of the invisible God. He is something that we can behold. We beheld his glory as of the only begotten of the Father, full of grace and truth. And so we see in Christ the true light of God manifest to us. That's all for today, and I look forward to continuing this next week. May God bless you.